Kristen Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
Hello there, Marjorie Egan.
Hello there, Jim Browdy.
Debate over whether we need more gun laws, everybody knows, is heating up in New England in particular. We've heard from both sides in the last 24 hours. Yesterday, 1,000 gun rights activists rallied against more gun laws on Boston Common. And today, as you just heard, the governor of Connecticut signs the toughest state law in the nation, while Congress, of course, has no idea what it's doing. First, we'll hear from someone at the rally, and then Connecticut's governor.
We will not surrender. We will not give up.
This bill is a very good bill, very far-reaching, arguably the most comprehensive in the country on a state basis in its entirety.
Joining us on the phone is one of the organizers of yesterday's gun rights rally on Boston Common. He's the head of the Gun Owners Action League. He is Jim Wallace. Good afternoon, Jim.
Hey, guys. How are we doing? And before we get going, congratulations on the new show. It's good that you found a home and everybody gets to hear you again.
We're happy to be home. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you very much, Jim. So it's clear to me, Jim, from reading the stories today and from following you guys for a while, that there is a real feeling among gun rights advocates that the government's going to come take their guns away. Where does that come from? I mean, it seems to me it's crazy.
Well, I mean, Margie, you got to understand, back in 1998 when the Gun Control Act was passed here in Massachusetts, there was 1.5 million licensed gun owners in the state of Massachusetts. And current day, although it's been rising in the last couple of years, that number was reduced down to about 250,000 at one point until it started to rebound. So, you know, an 80% to 85% reduction in licensed gun owners, I mean, that's the government coming to take your guns because of the laws that were passed in 1998, because they went retroactive in a lot of the issues that they passed back then.
Is this the individual police chiefs in local towns refusing the permits? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, it's a combination of several things, because in 1998, they came up with new disqualifiers that included misdemeanors. That were punishable by any misdemeanor punishable by more than 2 years was an automatic disqualifier. And that was brand new back in 1998, and they went retroactive to date of birth after that law passed. So people who had had gun licenses for 20, 30, 40 years suddenly lost their right to own a firearm because of something happened. You know, they're now 60, 70 years old, something that happened in their 20s or their teens, and they lost their right to own a gun. So, I mean, we have very, very genuine concerns when more legislation is passed, especially in light of what has happened to us here in Massachusetts in the last decade and a half.
That's the voice of Jim Wallace. He's the executive director of GOAL, the Gun Owners Action League. Our number is 877-301-8970. As this debate intensifies, Marjorie and I are interested in hearing, has anybody's mind been changed as a result of what they've heard from the president, from Jim Wallace, from the NRA? Has anybody's mind been changed? Is there anything that's on the president's agenda or Deval Patrick's agenda in Massachusetts, Jim Wallace? Universal background checks, which are supported by anywhere from 80 to 90% of Americans, even though the number is declining. Is there any new gun law that GOAL would support?
Well, one of the things we definitely have to look at, and we've actually been trying to work with the government for well over a decade now, is the mental health issue. I mean, if you remember going back, I'm sure the two of you covered it at one point or another, the Wakefield tragedy.
Muckle McDermott.
We met with Jane Swift even back then and urged her to form a commission of mental health experts, criminologists, whatever they need to do, to try to find out ways of identifying potential murderers ahead of time. And unfortunately, the state and the nation, for the most part, really hasn't done anything with the mental health issue. And unfortunately, now we're starting to see some of the results of that. And, you know, the governor has a piece of his legislation anyway, is to report persons to the federal government with mental health issues. Unfortunately, his bill is written incorrectly. What it says is people who have been confined, and what it's supposed to say is people who have been adjudicated. And we've tried to communicate that to the governor and the committees that have handled it. Unfortunately, still now, what, 5.5 years into his term, the governor still refuses to meet with us, so it's impossible to tell him what's wrong with the bill.
But he's actually going to be in studio with us next Tuesday, Jim. We'll pass along your message and see if it causes a meeting of the minds. But let me get to the broader issue, not just the mental health aspect. Universal background checks, whether you agree with the actual statistics or not, some say 60% currently are subject to those checks, 40% are not. Is there any decent reason other than fear of a slippery slope as to why we shouldn't have a background check on everybody who purchases a gun?
Well, I mean, Jim, you got to look at like what I just said. We're not on a slippery slope. We're on a steep cliff. So before we would accept anything else, somebody somewhere has to prove that what they did to us here in Massachusetts 15 years ago has had any value. And unfortunately, it hasn't. We actually just released a report from all the numbers from the Department of Public Health. Even though our numbers of licensed gun owners have been decreased by 80% because of the laws, gun crime in Massachusetts has gone through the roof. Matter of fact, since 1998, gun-related homicides are up 100%, and gun-related assaults are up 200%. And according to the FBI, aside from gun issues, Massachusetts is the most violent state in the Northeast. So
you know that, Jim. I don't want to, Jim. I read that study, too. You, of course, know, and we're not going to resolve it here today, that a report soon after that from Boston Children's Hospital found that states with the highest number of gun laws had the lowest rates of gun deaths due to homicides and suicides. So there is an unresolved debate about whether or not the laws really work.
No, not at all, because that report was actually, Jim, said the most gun laws. That's all it said. It actually had a list of do you have two laws, do you have three laws, do you have four laws, do you have five laws. That's all that report meant. And any logical person who understood that and read that report said, well, this is useless. This doesn't give us any information. So if I have 400 pages versus 300 pages of gun laws, that means they're better? No, not at all. I mean, just look at Massachusetts. There's a retired police chief in Massachusetts that makes a side living on publishing a 400-page book on how to begin to understand the Massachusetts gun laws. Now, come on. If a citizen needs a 400-page book to begin to understand what's expected of them, we got a problem.
That is a persistent government problem when we write these laws. They go on pages and pages and pages. Our numbers are 877-301-8970. If you want to talk about your feelings on the gun rally yesterday, your feelings about tighter gun laws, our email address is bpr@wgbh.org.
I also want to know, as I said before, is one person listening to the show change their mind on this issue as a result of the debate that's been really high profile, at least since Newtown?
Jim Wallace, I've also read that one of the big fears on your side about background checks is there's going to be some kind of gun registry all around the country.
Well, certainly. I mean, we actually have gun registration here in Massachusetts. It's actually illegal, but it exists. And obviously what they're going to look for is when they pass laws, for instance, what's in the pipeline now, which is technically the government isn't going to confiscate your guns, but they're just going to make them illegal to possess. So certainly if they have a gun registry, they're going to start coming after people once they have that registry. And I mean, that actually happened in California, where one year they actually made everybody register their large capacity firearms. And then 2 years later, they passed a bill to ban them. So they knew exactly what they were doing in the gun registry. And again, here in Massachusetts, they do have a list, a database of guns that we own, but there's actually nothing in the laws that actually allows them to do that. So those are things that we look at, and it's a trust issue. If you're doing things that are not within the law, then why should we trust you to do anything else that's reasonable?
Well, one of the things, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, but one of the laws that I think was a great idea, frankly, is that you couldn't get a gun permit in Massachusetts if you had a history of domestic violence, of attacking your wife or your girlfriend. I don't know. If I were in that situation, I wouldn't want my ex-husband or boyfriend to have a gun. Is that unreasonable?
Well, it's not unreasonable as long as we understand the definitions. And this is a tough one to talk about because it's a serious issue. Domestic violence is a serious issue. But unfortunately, in some cases, the courts have expanded what a family member is out to the point of, I'll give you an example. We had a gentleman, and this was several years ago, but he came to us and said his wife had passed away 3 years ago or 2 years ago, and he went back to one of the family where she came from to a barbecue just to say hi to everybody. He got in a scuffle with his ex-brother-in-law because of something he said about his former wife. And next thing you know, he's being charged with assault and battery on a family member. So it's always the devil's in the details.
Yeah, but Jim, if I can stop you. Jim, based on that kind of reasoning, we should abolish every law in this country because there's no law which doesn't have an aberrational abuse of an individual or several. The question is to root those out. But I want to ask you about something that I thought was pretty chilling from yesterday's rally. And admittedly, I wasn't there, but I read about it in today's Globe. Let me read to you the end of the Globe story.
If you were there, you'd have been chilling.
Well, maybe I would have. Maybe I would have. But this particularly was chilling to me, Jim Wallace.
And he would stand out in the crowd, too, Jim. You know? That's why he couldn't go.
One of your speakers was this guy, Ying Lee. And here's what he said. One of the proudest moments for me as a father was the day last year when his young son first shot a training rifle at a target. After he spoke at the rally, Lee held up the target, riddled with bullets within a human outline, many in the head. I treasure this. At 6 years old, the story concludes, Lee recalled his son assured him he would use the rifle to protect his brother and sister when Lee was traveling for business. Now, when you heard that yesterday, did you not say to yourself, God, I wish he hadn't said that?
No, because you didn't hear the last part of that.
What was it?
When he actually had to tell his child that the gun has to be locked up here in Massachusetts and you won't be able to touch it until you get your FID card at 16.
Yeah, I understand that, but let me tell you, I would bet that the kid's enthusiasm at 16 might outweigh his father explaining to him what the rules of the road are. I mean, the whole notion that this enthusiasm exists in a little boy about firing at a rifle at somebody who he thinks is threatening his sister and mother, to me at least, is a little upsetting. In any case, let me give the number, if I can. 877. Wait, Jim, hold a second. 877-301-8970. If you want to speak to Jim Wallace, want to weigh in on the whole issue. Again, within 24 hours, two dramatically different sides were heard loud and clear. 1,000 people at a gun rights rally yesterday at Boston Common. And obviously, as you heard today, Governor Malloy in Connecticut is signing the nation's toughest gun law, obviously, in the wake of Newtown. I'm sorry, Jim. Take it.
Oh, that's okay. What you may also not understand is Yang Li was actually in Tiananmen Square.
No, I read that.
When that happened. So he takes freedom very seriously, and he's trying to teach his children the responsibility of freedom. And that's why he was so proud of the statement that his son made, was that his son said, you know, I will try to protect mom and the sisters as long as, you know, when you're not here. And that's what he was very proud of. And any parent should be proud of that, whether it's, you know, but the child's trying to say that he's trying to be a man and stand up because he understands what freedom is and he understands what happens.
Got it.
You know,
you can be proud if your six-year-old says, I will dial 911 the second intruder threatens my family. It just, this to me, again, is a little scary. Let me ask you one more thing. Bill Sherlock, his wife was a school psychologist at Newtown. He was interviewed on CBS National News the other night. Here's what he said about the high-capacity magazines. It's just simple arithmetic. If you have to change magazines 15 times instead of 5 times, you have 3 times as many incidents where something could jam, something could be bobbled. You know that in Oregon, that in Arizona, that essentially the shooter in these major cases was tackled, was stopped while they were changing these magazines. What's the argument against banning high-capacity magazines? What's the argument?
Well, I guess the question should be, what's the argument for banning them? Because
you can shoot, people. And you're asking the question. I want to answer it. I'm so good.
Well, you have millions and millions of these things that are owned lawfully and responsibly and without incident. But because of a couple of deranged individuals who caused severe tragedies, we're going to ban something that millions of other people own without incident. If we ever took that kind of mentality and applied it to anything else that happens in this country, there wouldn't be a car on the road. There wouldn't be anything going on in our schools after time because kids are always being killed or injured in after-school programs. There wouldn't be any kind of, I mean, even horseback riding. You know how many people get hurt in horseback riding? They would ban every horse in this country.
You know, Jim, you know what's surprising about what you're just saying here, Jim, is you picked one example of an abuse of a law to suggest that it shouldn't happen. I can list for you a number of cases which are not just anecdotal, but fairly widespread, where carnage, far greater carnage, was able to be committed by a shooter because of his ability to shoot as many rounds as quickly as he possibly could. So why does one anecdote persuade you there shouldn't be a law, but another set of anecdotes doesn't convince you at all that there should be?
Because I'm not talking about anecdotes. I'm talking about facts. So let me
I'm talking about facts, too. These are all true.
Okay, how many rounds is okay for a criminal?
You picked the number. How about 10 or 15?
Yeah, I go with 10.
Let's settle for 15. How about 20? How about 23? How about 33? Is there any number of rounds in a high-capacity magazine where you would say enough is enough, or no?
Well, no, because what I asked you is how many rounds are okay for a criminal, because that's what we're talking.
Well, I'll give you an example. Again, let's talk about Jared Loughner just for a second, who obviously shot Gabby Giffords and other people. You know the facts probably as well, if not better than I. He was tackled while he was attempting to reload a magazine into his gun. If he had had a higher capacity magazine, by definition, there'd be more dead people around Gabby Giffords. Is that not a fact? I mean, that's a fact.
But again, it's a criminal issue you're talking about. It's not a lawful person issue. How many rounds is it okay for a criminal to have? Because that's what we're talking about. My whole idea is for a criminal would be zero. For a lawful citizen who has done absolutely nothing wrong and who has exercised its civil right to have those things, millions of them across the country, and has done nothing wrong with them, as a matter of fact, has used them safely for decades,
but
why would we want to take anything away from them? Because we're not focusing on the human criminal element, and that's the problem we have here in Massachusetts.
We're going to get to the cause in 1 second. We've got a lot of people on the line, Jim Wallace. But one of the things, a lot of these people are not criminals until they've killed 20 people or 25 people. And when you talk about getting at the mental health aspect, you know, in the Newtown shooter's case, his own father repeatedly was trying to get him committed without any success. And in Loughner's case, the father tried to take the car away from him because he knew he was in tough shape, too. So I'm not sure how you get at it from the mental health perspective, because there's so much privacy around this, and as you probably know, it's really difficult to commit anybody against their will, no matter how wacky they may appear.
Yeah, that is certainly something that's going to have to be tackled at some point, you know, whether it happens in 6 months or 6 years, but it's definitely something that needs to, I mean, the amazing thing is, guys, that since Connecticut happened, I've had a lot of people email me that I didn't even know, and just said to me, you know, that they're basically asking for help, that they indeed had children with severe mental illness that were violent all the time, and they had no place to go with these kids.
And those people will be able to get, but those people can get any kind of guns they want. That's what's scary to me, is that, you know, the Lanzas of the world, the Loughners of the world can go out, because until they commit the massive slaughters, you know what I'm saying? They're not criminals. That's the problem. Well, anyway, let's take some calls.
That's like saying that somebody, you know, who doesn't go into a liquor store and doesn't buy alcohol and get drunk out of their mind and run through a file of 10 children isn't illegal until they do it. So, I mean, how do you live in a free society and tell literally millions of people across the country who've done nothing wrong that we need to restrict you because somebody else might commit a crime?
I guess because
That's like saying if somebody in your neighborhood, committed a crime, that we're going to now put a curfew on your entire neighborhood, and if you're out after 8 o'clock because all the crimes were committed after 8 o'clock, we're going to put you in prison.
Well, no, it's not, though, Jim. It's like saying people can't have tanks and bazookas in there, no matter how law-abiding they are, because it can do too much carnage. But let's get to some calls. We've got Michael on the phone from Concord. You're on the air with Jim Wallace from the Gun Owners Action League. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, Michael.
Yes, I wanted to comment on abolishing all laws, or your statement that you're saying we have to abolish all the laws. And my comment is that with all of our other fundamental rights, they are not subject to restrictions. We're only subject to consequences if we abuse those liberties to bring harm to others. And those liberties are only abridged after due process. All of the things you're talking about are blanket restrictions prior to due process. We're saying innocent people, law-abiding people who have broken no law, brought harm to no one, are subject to restrictions. We have no day in court. We have no way to appeal these things. So if you want to compare to our other rights, you have to look at how those other rights are restricted. If you yell fire in a movie theater, you are charged after the fact. You are found guilty by a court of law, and then your rights are abridged. The other comment I wanted to make.
Well, wait,
let's
stay with the first one for a second.
Sure.
So is your contention? I wasn't clear where you're starting with. Is your contention that we should have no prescriptive gun laws? We should just have penalties for crimes that were committed with guns? Is that where you're going?
I'm saying that if you want to start from where we are and ask the question of do we need more laws or less laws, or are the laws that we have working? The laws that we have already restrict our freedoms beyond those of any other fundamental right.
No, but I'm saying the natural extension, but I'm asking you the question. So the natural extension is we shouldn't have any laws, you're suggesting. I'm asking you this, restricting gun. Well, let me finish your thought, Michael. I'm responding to you. Restricting gun ownership, we should only have laws that penalize people for improper or criminal use of guns. Is that correct?
As the standard for review of the First Amendment exists, yes. The error is on the side of protecting innocent people. You have to show that they've done something wrong before you can take away.
Well, actually, with all due respect, you're wrong, because the answer is, you say there's no remedy. The remedy is go to the Supreme Court of the United States or a federal court and say it's violating the United States Constitution. And
with the First Amendment, you can't stop me from speaking until you go to the court to get an order to say I can't speak, or something that I have already said has caused harm.
Not following.
I have to say, I hear you, Michael, but you're losing this both. Thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Bob and Melrose. You were next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie.
Jim and Marjorie.
Hey,
Hi,
Bob.
Jim and Marjorie. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
I have a couple of comments I'd like to make, and the first is that, you know, in this argument, well, first of all, let me say I'm a licensed gun owner in Massachusetts. I'm fully licensed both in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire. I've been fully licensed in 5 states in my life. I've taken numerous gun safety courses before being licensed, and I feel that I'm a competent firearm owner. But I do not agree with your guest, and I'd like to say why. When you discuss aspects of gun ownership with him, he has one set of anecdotal arguments. They are all anecdotal arguments. The second thing he does when you start talking about mental health, which he wants to make the primary issue, is suddenly he morphs into a mental health expert. So he's going to advise the governor on how to define issues related to mental health as they impact gun ownership. Now, are there any qualifications for that? I don't believe that there are. Secondly, I would just like to say that if I have a car that's set up to have 1,000 horsepower and a race car, effectively, that I would race at a track, the government does not allow me to take that onto the highway. So, and there's no indication that because the government bans those types of machines, that their intent to take away all cars or car or restrict.
We got it, Bob. Let's let Jim Wallace respond to what you had to say. Jim from the Gun Owners Action League, what's your response to what Bob has to say?
Well, first of all, I never claimed to be a mental health expert, and you know, unfortunately, I guess I kind of am a legislative expert, and that's the problem, is because what the federal government is looking for the NICS checks is indeed people who have been adjudicated. I mean, what level? I don't know. I never said I was an expert at it. But that's what the government's looking for, is people who have been adjudicated. They've gone through the process. The problem with the governor's bill is he says confined, and there's no definition as to what confined is. So you don't have to be a mental health expert or even claim to be one to understand the difference in a potential statute, that if they don't have the definition correctly, then it shouldn't be passed until it is correct.
Jim, thanks. Bob from Melrose, thank you. By the way, the governor of Connecticut, just talk about the odd juxtaposition of these conversations. Governor Malloy just signed the toughest gun law into law. Hey, Jim Wallace from the Gun Owners Action League, you have a problem with different states having different sets of laws? For example, we have in Massachusetts. I don't mean how tough or weak they are. Massachusetts, quite strict. New Hampshire, quite weak. What's your take on the right or wisdom of individual states passing their own gun laws as opposed to some federal law?
Well, you know, the big problem with that, Jim, is as soon as you cross state lines, it's like having a driver's license that isn't recognized in New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Vermont, or whatever, that if you have a specific, you know, right to own or possess in a certain state and you suddenly cross the state line, that you could be a convicted felon for doing nothing other than exercising a right you had in the state you came from. And that's one of the things that we wanted to make sure of on the national level when the NRA was pushing the reciprocity law, was to make sure that we weren't having people imprisoned or at least convicted as a felon simply because they crossed the state line. So that's an interesting conversation that we really haven't had to have, or shouldn't say had to have, but shouldn't haven't been able to have.
We're actually having it all the time. People like Tom Menino, who's one of the toughest pro-gun control activists in the country, says the biggest problem we have and the reason why we need federal laws, same thing that's said by the governor of New York City, is because of exactly what we're talking about. Is you go to New Hampshire, buy something you can't buy here, bring it back here, and you do something unkind to your fellow man. So I think it is being discussed. But in any case, Jim, thanks.
Jim Wallace,
that's already illegal.
One last quick question for me, Jim, before you go. I wonder what you make of the fact, I mean, Newtown, Connecticut itself, you know, northeastern state, more of a liberal state, not that dissimilar from Massachusetts. But Colorado has also passed very tough laws. And, of course, Colorado is where Columbine happened back in the late 90s and just more recently, tragically, the Aurora movie house shooting. I find it interesting that Colorado, because they were the scene of these two awful tragedies, has managed to pass these gun laws. Is that, I mean, that's a horrible thought, but is that what it takes?
Well, you know, I would hope not, because one of the things you hope is that you don't have knee-jerk reactions and people are reaching for what they consider to be easy solutions when sometimes there are no easy solutions to issues like this. And, you know, as far as Colorado, I mean, Connecticut, I understand Maryland just passed some things. Unfortunately, what they're going to find, because they're all following the same path, like New York did, that 10 years down the road, they're going to be scratching their heads because the laws aren't going to work. They're not going to reduce crime. They're not going to stop incidences like Connecticut. And the sad thing is, if you look at all the proposals, whether it's the national proposal, the White House, the feds, states, all of this, the catalyst was Sandy Hook. And there is nothing in any of these pieces of proposed legislation or policy that will do anything to prevent another Sandy Hook.
Well, you know, and with all due respect, Jim, I know that's your position.
Will.
Assault weapons, magazines, yeah. A whole host of things. You don't know they're going to work, but your contention is that I assume that criminals can circumvent anything they want to do and do horrible
but
deeds.
Jim, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. I appreciate it.
Hey, for half hour with the Jim and Marjorie show.
Thank you.
Hey, Jim Wallace, thanks
Jim
so much.
Jim Wallace, Executive Director of the Gun Owners Action League. Okay, up next. There's a big issue that started to divide our nation right down the aisle, literally, and that is the practice of charging airline passengers by the pound. That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan on Boston Public Radio. As you know, air traffic controllers are gone at five smaller airports in Massachusetts. And in more airline news, one airline says, Marjorie wrote about it this morning, if you're bigger, you'll pay more to fly. Samoa Airlines, not a big one, but it could be a groundbreaker, will charge by the pound. Joining us is Somerville-based pilot. He has the great Ask the Pilot blog. It's actually askthepilot.com. And he's an air travel writer. He is Patrick Smith. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
Hi, Patrick. What I'm really fascinated by is this pay by the pound thing. But before we get to that, should we be nervous about there not being enough air traffic controllers out there watching us fly in and out of Logan or Hyannis?
Well, it's not Logan. It's these smaller airports.
Yeah,
well,
I know, but it could be Logan if things keep going this way. So flying out of Logan or these smaller airports like Hyannis and Vermont, et cetera, where they're already more worried because they are small?
Well, you know, from my perspective as an airline pilot, this is really a non-issue. It really pertains only to very small airports that are used almost entirely by private traffic.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's an issue, not at the
not yet.
Airline,
not yet.
At the airline end of things. No, and I don't think it will be. There's just too much at stake in terms of commerce and the economy. And, you know, it's interesting. I don't really understand where this came from. You know, the various taxes and fees that are attached to airfares are supposed to be funding the FAA and most of these things that are being cut back. So I don't really understand how the sequester is having these impacts at least minimally at the commercial level at all.
Okay. Well, if it's not a big deal, then we're not even going to worry about
it. Well, I am worried about it. Explain to me how it works at one of these smaller airports with private planes. If there's nobody in the air traffic tower, what are you, pilots talk to each other?
They wave out the window.
How does a plane land and take off? I'm worried about it.
And there was a story in the Globe today about the Worcester Airport and JetBlue starting service there. And the line they used was because of the cutbacks, you know, the pilots are going to have to, quote unquote, coordinate their own arrivals and departures. And you imagine this this kind of bizarre scene.
Exactly.
It's really not that rudimentary. There are protocols for this sort of thing. It's not common, but it does happen. You do sometimes, even as a commercial airline pilot, fly into or out of what we call an uncontrolled field. That's a horrible way to put it, because you tend to imagine this very dangerous,
out of control,
kind of free-for-all environment. It's really not like that, and getting into how exactly would entail kind of a flying lesson that we could talk all day about.
Just maybe ignorance is bliss in this context.
Do you have
Patrick?
Any more questions about this, Jim? Because I really want to move on.
Let's move on.
By the pound. I mean, this is Samoa Air, and it's a tiny airline, and right now it flies mostly little teeny tiny planes, you know, 3 people, 10 people, 12 people, or something. But they have put in this new policy where they're actually weighing passengers at the check-in counter. You're asked actually to give your estimate when you first book it. So you say you're 150 pounds. Then it turns out when you get at the weigh-in, you're actually 175 pounds. So they're weighing you, and then they're weighing your luggage, and they're charging you by the pound. They're also considering doing this when they get bigger airplanes, and apparently some of the big airlines have even thought about this. What do you make of this?
Again, this is something that pertains to a very, very tiny fraction of the industry. Very small airplanes. In the case of the Samoan carrier, I think these are 5 or 6 seaters. Piston-powered.
Up to 12. Yeah.
There's really no application for this at the major airline level.
What about Cape Air? They could be doing it when you fly from Hyannis to Nantucket.
I believe their planes are 10-seaters,
mm-hmm.
9 passengers plus 1 pilot.
Yep.
Again, that's kind of a different category.
Well, wait, Patrick, I have been asked to switch sides on flights from Boston to on a Cape Air flight from Boston to Provincetown, so that there is a weight balance on the flight.
Right.
So it's
Jim, that's Cape Air you're talking about. Yeah. These are single pilot piston powered twin Cessnas. These aren't 747s. They're not even regional jets. It's really another category altogether.
Well,
and
but
at a bigger level. One of the reasons this really isn't a story is because passengers make up such an overall tiny fraction of a plane's overall weight. I mean, let's take the case of a 747, for example. 420 people,
right?
Assuming the plane is full, and all of their luggage together comprise only about, it's less than 10% of the plane's total maximum takeoff weight. So think about that.
But let's talk about the small airlines. I mean, Cape Air. That's what I'm saying. Cape Air could do what Samoa Air does, because Americans, unfortunately, are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I've been on a Cape Air plane a couple of times. When you do see really big passengers and you think to yourself, my goodness, are we going to get off the ground?
It could be a factor.
I can't be the only one thinking about that, Patrick.
For somebody like Cape Air, a niche carrier, an unusual carrier in that they use very small airplanes in a very local market, you know, this could be something for them to think about. But it's not something that you're going to see at, you know, your Americans, Deltas, and Uniteds. It's just not going to happen.
Well, let me just say that, but it is happening to a small degree. Patrick Smith of AskThePilot. Is it .com or .org? My apologies.
.com.
Is that we used to work with a guy who complained about the fact that because his girth was rather whatever, I won't use an adjective, he had to pay for 2 seats. And you also hear people in America, as we become a larger and larger society, people on airlines, I think Marjorie may have quoted one or two in her column today, who are upset because people are, what's the polite term here?
Splaying over.
Or splaying over into someone else. So there is an issue of larger Americans flying on commercial flights that these commercial airlines are going to have to deal with, even if it turns out it's not with what is being derisively called a fat tax, a poundage kind of thing. So the issue itself is an issue, no?
I would agree with you. You're getting into a slightly different issue and a different way of looking at it. Here's one way, though, that this could result in some sort of change, in that when calculating takeoff and landing weights, we use standard flat weights for each passenger,
mm-hmm.
Depending whether it's winter or summer, to include the passenger and his or her bags. It's just one number, 190 pounds in the winter for everybody. That number was increased, I believe, in the last 10 years. I think it went up 10 pounds. So it could conceivably, in the reasonably near future, go up another 10 pounds. And that kind of takes into account, I guess, our expanding waistlines.
To say the least.
Our numbers, by the way, are 877-301-897, 877-301, I gave it wrong, 877-301-8970. If you want to weigh in on what could be coming, at least on smaller airlines, paying by the pound. I mean, can you just imagine going up to the check-in counter and there you are, you know, you got to do all this stuff already. You have to take off your belt, you have to take off your shoes, you have to go through the naked body scanner, have the TSA people, you know, padding around your body, then they're going to ask you how much you weigh. I mean, it's just going to be terrific.
I think you're both defining this too narrowly. It's what I said a minute ago. The large passenger on a plane is a big issue, even if the solution, as Patrick says, is not going to be to weigh the passenger when they get to the counter to get their ticket. The whole issue of us being such a bigger society fitting into relatively small seats and planes is a big deal.
Patrick. Yeah, there's definitely something to that, and how it pans out, we'll have to wait and see. You know, it's interesting. People often complain about skinny seats and the lack of legroom and cramped cabins. And,
yep.
You know, really, if you look over the past 3 decades or so, the dimensions and the seating layouts of the typical cabin really haven't changed. If anything, they're slightly roomier now than they were 20 or 30 years ago. Anybody who remembers People Express, you know, can attest to that, just how cramped a cabin could be, or the old Laker Airways.
Do you remember hey, Patrick, to show your airline knowledge, I will quiz you before we let you go. What was the verb that was, I used to fly People Express for $19 each way to New York. What was the verb that was created by People Express that was never in the English language before?
Wow.
You ready?
I don't know.
The issue was they would beverage you. We were about to beverage you, the flight attendant said. Hey, Patrick Smith, my screen just went dark. What's the name of your forthcoming book?
The book is going to be called Cockpit Confidential, which is not at all a derivative title. Thank you, Anthony Bourdain. Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. It comes out officially on May 1st. You can order on Amazon now.
Patrick Smith, thank you very much for being with us. Patrick is, of course, a Somerville-based pilot, and in addition to his book, he's also got the great blog, AskThePilot.com. We want to ask you guys now at 877-301-8970 whether you think this is okay. You know, I was at Logan yesterday interviewing a bunch of people about this. Not surprisingly, the bigger the people, the less they like this idea. If they weighed 150 pounds, they were okay with it because they didn't like themselves sitting next to somebody who was really heavy on a big airline. But this flight attendant I talked to, who'd been flying for 33 years, Samoans are big people. That's one of the reasons he does on Samoan Air. They're very big people. And she talked about, in the 33 years she's been flying, how people have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And there is a lot of aggression on airlines now between the big people and the not so big people, and the big people are embarrassed
having to get the
flight, the seatbelt extender.
Extenders, yeah, extenders.
And there's a lot of animosity when they do splay over into the seat next to them. So it's becoming a big deal.
Our number is 877-301-8970. What do you think about the pound by pound rate? And Patrick says it's not going to come to major airlines, but what's a variation on that theme has come to major airlines. Some airlines, as I discussed before, some major airlines require you, if you're large, to buy two seats. That essentially is a pound tax,
Jim,
is it not?
There's a lot of smaller airlines, and this is affecting them too. Let's go to Eileen from Plymouth. Eileen, what do you think about this whole thing?
Well, I think it should be a matter of girth, not weight.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is unrealistic, but perhaps the airlines can make bigger seats and charge people more. I mean, how many people really and truly need to be that big? And I know I sound intolerant, but I had a horrible experience sitting between two people who were really, really big, and I had just the most miserable flight I've ever had in my life.
Eileen, you're talking about a tape measure instead of a scale?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Can you imagine the scene at check-in? Some people get tape measured, some people get weighed. That's the thing, Eileen. It's pretty embarrassing.
It's not realistic.
Yeah.
But for people who aren't big, it's miserable.
Well, especially in the summertime when everybody's in shorts.
No, but it is. Well, I know what you're going to say.
Eileen, thank you very much.
Eileen, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
877-301-8970. We're talking about a real problem. Again, even if Patrick's right and the pound, the weigh-in is not going to be part of your airline future, other than maybe on small planes, there is a real issue about very large people. And by the way, I'm a pretty large person.
You are a very large person, which is why I was going to ask you.
What were you going to ask?
How did you feel when you got on that Cape Air plane when they ask you to move from the port side to the starboard side?
It's actually starboard to port.
Whatever it was.
It was a tad embarrassing.
Did they say to you, Mr. Browdy,
no.
You're a big man. I mean, how did they phrase this?
They were very polite, and they said, sir, would you mind, for reasons of balance, would you mind sitting on one side? Now, the problem, I know what you're thinking, Margie, it was me on one side and five people but that was
on the other
fine,
side.
Fine, thank you. Let's move on. Let's go to Larry in Cambridge. You are next with Jim and Marjorie. We're talking about the issue, you know, this issue, large people on planes, which is not a non-issue on, this is Boston Public Radio. Hey, Larry. Great.
Great show.
Thanks. What's up?
I'm thinking that, you know, this pay for the by the pound, it would work in like 90% of the cases. Now, you got to talk about people that have glandular problems that do not have any control over their weight. I mean, they're going to be penalized as much as the people that overeat and that are just morbidly obese because they have no willpower.
Yeah, but Larry,
do a Dorito quiz.
Larry, this is a horrible connection. We got to let you go, and I'm sorry. There are lots of situations in life where how much something weighs, I don't mean this disrespectfully, that's how much you pay for it. I mean, is that not the case in most of our lives? Now, Patrick makes a good point.
Like at the post office. By weight for the parcel.
But if Patrick Smith's point is a good point, that the weight of the passenger is insignificant in terms of the grand, how much the plane itself, how much weight is on the plane itself, what is not insignificant is the size of the passenger. And by the way, this is not disrespectful on anybody. I mean, I have been really big in my life, and I know that when I was really big, and I don't mean tall, sitting next to me on a plane was not a joy. And if you're in a middle seat and you have one of me on one side and another one of me on another side, it's not a non-issue.
Well, I interviewed these two guys yesterday at Logan, and they were both big guys, and they were saying how they'd just flown into Logan behind a Chicago Bears football player. They didn't know his name, but they said how the poor woman next to the Chicago Bears middle linebacker was like squished up against the window.
No, of course it is. It's horrible.
He was a big man.
I was going to say it's a huge issue, but I won't. Peter in Salem, you are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Peter.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Well, I was just telling earlier, the issue really, in my view, is not so much the distance between seats, which is what airlines will advertise, you know, the pitch. What they call the pitch is the distance between one seat behind the other, normally around 31 to 34 inches, but they've never, over the course of my career, ever increased the width of seats. Mm-hmm. And I believe you do a little research, you'll find that when the 747s and the DC-10s first came out, they were actually advertised to have one less row of seats. Not row, one less aisle. So instead of being, say, 10 across, they'd only have nine, mm-hmm. I think nine across. And the airlines very quickly decided, well, they could shave off a few inches and put a whole a lot more passengers on the airplane, which, you know, dictates the economies of air travel.
No, that's
So, Peter, what is the solution? I mean, on one hand, you have the airlines. Obviously, the more people they put in seats, the more money they make. On the other side, you have bigger Americans. I mean, we all know this. So as a retired pilot, what's the solution, Peter?
I sat next to a gentleman coming up from Florida some years ago, and he was just a big person. He was 6'2", maybe, not at all overweight, looked like an athlete. He was just big, and the poor guy was in the middle seat, and I'm not very big myself, but he was clearly uncomfortable. And the solution is, I don't know if there's a solution. You can try charging more money for a bigger seat or, put less seats on the airplane, but my former employer tried doing that for a while, and it bombed. They took one row of seats out and had a little more spacing between the seats, and it didn't fly.
Hey, Peter, thanks for the call. Next thing the major airlines will be doing is strapping big people to the top of the planes. I mean,
it'll be like, remember the funny thing during the election when, you know, Seamus, of course, was the dog that Mitt Romney put on the roof of his car.
On the way
to
Canada.
He took a lot of grief about it. And there was a great picture of a 747 taking off when his wife... horse was in the Olympics.
Had the dressage horse, yeah.
Strapped
to the top of the 747.
747. It was kind of funny. It wasn't so funny, I guess, if you were Mitt Romney. Anyway, I don't think, have we solved this problem, Jim?
No, but it's for those people to suggest that it is a non-problem. I read some of the comments in your story in the Herald today. It is not a non-problem. And maybe, again, maybe the solution is not a per pound fee to ride on a plane, but you know something has got to be done for the comfort of the passengers spending a ton of money.
This
and
is why
I didn't
we
mean
need,
that as a bunny.
This is why we need high-speed trains. We won't have
Maybe
this problem in high-speed trains. Anyway, Late Night is going to have a new leading mad man next year. Excuse me. Jimmy Fallon is going to take over Jay Leno's Late Night throne. What does this mean for the future of After Dark television? We're going to talk about that next on Boston Public Radio.
Listen, Boston Public Radio, I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. It is official. You all know this. You read it probably in the last 24 hours. Leno is out next spring. Jimmy Fallon is in a new franchise in the show, which really started Late Night Talk. And so our question for you at 877-301-8970, is late night network television still relevant in your lives? And who sits atop the pantheon of Tonight Show hosts? And is Jay Leno even in the pantheon of great late night show hosts? One of our colleagues has put together a great montage in chronological order from Steve Allen, who started the Tonight Show thing, through Jack Parr, Johnny Carson, Conan O'Brien, who was there like for a minute and a half, Jay Leno, and now Jimmy Fallon. Listen up.
Howdy. Thanks very much. Thanks very much. Good evening, and thank you for letting me come into your homes. Just wanted to say it before you could turn me off. Sneaked in there. We've been having...
Mr. Nixon plays a piano, see. Anyhow, I heard some time ago from a friend of his that he wrote a selection, wrote a composition. We have hired about 15 Democratic violinists to fill out the...
This is kind of a strange audience. Have you noticed that? How strange is it? Well, before the show tonight, a sweet elderly lady came up to me and says, you know, I'd like to capture you on canvas. And I says, you mean to like to paint my portrait? And she says, no, I've got an army cot in my Winnebago.
CBS's lawyers sent an email to musicians that are going to perform on the Grammys that said, please avoid exposing bare fleshy undercurves of the buttocks and buttock crack. Yeah, of course, I get the same email before every show.
People were shocked. Congress has a gym? Anybody in Congress look like they work out, huh? Huh? Did it take Barney Frank 30 years to get that body? Really, him going every day? Huh? What's Harry Reid bench pressing, 5 pounds now?
I got to present an award with Jay Leno. Yeah, and you know, he's just so nice. When we were done, he personally drove me to the airport and made sure I got on my plane. That was just nice. Yeah, and he hurt my arm a little bit.
The five who've done it, and then Jimmy Fallon is about to do it. Our number's 877-301-8970. How big a role has late-night network television, The Tonight Show specifically, played in your life? And the conventional wisdom is there's Johnny Carson and everybody else. And even if it turns out you're not of a certain age, everybody's gone on YouTube or seen Johnny Carson, who really, in my estimation, was brilliant. Johnny Carson was such a huge part of my childhood and my mother's non-childhood, adulthood, parenthood kind of thing. But you get the sense today that with Jon Stewart and the Chelsea Handlers and all this sort of stuff, that even if Jay Leno was as great as I think he is not, that the whole Tonight Show franchise is sort of hanging by a thread. 877-301-8970. How important is the Tonight Show been to you? Who's the best at that franchise? And what do you think about Jay Leno, who apparently is doing quite well with lots of viewers, being replaced by Jimmy Fallon next spring? 877-301-8970. Were you a big Johnny Carson fan in your house?
Oh, absolutely.
And why is it, do you think, that he seemed to have captured the essence of what late-night television should be better than anybody else?
Because I think you never felt uncomfortable watching him. You always
knew
he
had a great point.
He had his comedy in hand. When the jokes didn't work. He had that in hand.
That's when he was funniest, by the way.
He just had great timing. He just to look at him, you started to laugh the way he would look at Ed McMahon. He was terrific. I'm a big fan of David Letterman. I've never gotten into Leno at all because Letterman's edgier. And even though Johnny Carson, I don't know if you call him exactly edgy, but there was just. He just did it perfectly. He just had more talent, I guess, than anybody else who's done it before.
Well, Steve Allen was a genius in his era. Steve Allen was before almost everybody's time. Well, I saw Steve Allen at the end of his career at The Tonight Show, and he was really smart, and his ad-libs were brilliant. And he also did the first totally offbeat, crazy humor on television.
In a totally different way.
Yeah.
I mean, because they're very different, obviously. I love Stephen Colbert. I mean, I just think he is a riot. I just look at him and I start to laugh the way he sits at his desk, the way he looks through his, you know, his beady little eyes there at you. I mean, I just think he's a riot. So
he's also been playing a character on television for years and years and years, and he never leaves the role. And it's brilliant. I agree with you. Our number is 877-301-8970. Are you going to miss Jay Leno? He's a Massachusetts guy, but I have to say, to me, it was almost hee-haw-esque, and I don't mean to be unkind. It was sort of middle of the country humor. It just never did it for me. Let's start with Chris in Brighton. You are next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the switchover on The Tonight Show. It's going to happen next spring. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, great.
Good.
I guess the thing I kind of wanted to bring up is, I'm 25. I'm part of the next generation, and I've never seen a live Johnny Carson show before.
You missed a great thing.
I'm sick of hearing about it. I truly am. it's like if you say you like rock and roll and everyone's like, the Beatles. Never going to be another Beatle.
So what do you watch? Well, there is never going to be another Beatle. What are you going to watch late? What do you watch late at night, Chris? What's the thing if you're up? What do you watch on television?
I really liked, NBC's Conan O'Brien. Didn't really like the switch to TBS. Kind of got a little too goofy for me. But now I like something that's a little bit more factual. I'm a big Daily Show guy.
Yeah, he's great.
Well, I don't know what the raw numbers are, but it's pretty clear to me that people in your demographic, let's say 18 to 29, maybe even 18 to 34, I would assume that Jon Stewart does far better than anybody on late night network television. Well, Chris, thanks for the call.
And there's all these.
Go ahead, final
go
thought.
Ahead.
Yeah.
No problem. I guess is, and I'll take this off air too. When you guys were watching Johnny Carson, did you guys know it was as great as it was now? Or is it just nostalgia looking back?
That's a great question, Chris. That's a great question.
You know what I think it is, Chris? I think it's in comparison to the guys that have done it since.
Well, that's what he's saying. Did you know then?
No, I had no idea.
That he was as great as he was.
No, I had no idea. I was a little kid. I thought everybody was going to be like Johnny Carson. I vaguely remember Jack Parr. He was crying all the time. No matter what it was, he was crying all the time.
Hey, by the way, Chris, let me also tell you, there's never been anything quite like a silent film. You got to check those out, too. Hey, Chris, thank you for your call and some great points. Let's go to Milton, where Paul is on the phone. Paul, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Great.
A word on Jack Parr, who I kind of grew up on.
Yeah, I was crying all the time. Why was that?
Well, yeah, but before that, the Kennedys really owe much of their success to the exposure they got on Jack Parr's show. He had JFK on. He had Robbie Kennedy on. He had Rose Kennedy on.
Really?
He had a set of regulars. His show was definitely more edgy than Steve Allen and definitely more edgy than Johnny Carson. Who succeeded him. So he almost doesn't fit into the same category. He's more like a Jon Stewart of the early 60s, in a sense.
But he had a certain creepiness to him. And I don't even mean, I know creepy is a pejorative term, and I don't mean it that way, but there was a certain oddness to him. Was there not, Paul?
Well, I think he what you saw in Jack Parr is what you got. I mean, I think that was probably, he was probably the real Jack Parr, what you saw. He came on as unfiltered. He did wear his emotions on the sleeve. Remember, he walked off the stage because he told a joke that used the term water closet in it back, and the censors took him off, censored the joke. I don't remember the joke. I remember the punchline. Mm-hmm. Something to do with a bathroom, a water closet, mm-hmm. which is a British term. He walked off the stage. He was so hurt and embarrassed that anybody would question his character, his moral character.
You know what his
and
great line about speaking of politics, my favorite quote, I often retell it quoting him when people don't vote. He says, "I never vote, it only encourages them," which is a pretty great
I kid you not, that was his other.
That was great. Hey, Paul, thank you for your contribution. We appreciate it. Let's try to squeeze one or two more quick ones in. Samantha, you're in the hometown of Marjorie Egan, Fall River. We're talking about The Tonight Show, Switch, and Tonight Show in general. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. It's nice to hear from you guys, Jim. I love listening to the show.
Great.
I just wanted to say I used to work third shift, and I found the Late Show with Craig Ferguson to be my absolute favorite.
Why is it? I have never warmed him. I know he does some of the July 4th stuff. I never quite got him. Why do you love him, Samantha?
I think that he really keeps me in the loop with everything that's going on. I find him quirky and intelligent and just very refreshing.
Yeah, he is smart. He is a smart guy. Well, have you seen the July 4th stuff he's done at all? What do you think of that?
I actually haven't yet. No, I switched over to first shift, so I have a little bit of catching up to do. But he definitely needs his dues.
Hey, Craig. Samantha, thank you for your call. I appreciate it.
You know what? Except for Chelsea Handler,
what's that?
There's no women anymore. Joan Rivers a million years ago was going to be Johnny Carson's replacement, and that never worked out. I don't know why.
I forgot about the Joan Rivers. Joan Rivers was supposed to be a success. What happened to that? I don't know.
Okay, Jimmy Fallon, as we know, a couple of months. When is it going to be, Jim? The end of?
No, it's not a couple of months. Spring of 2014.
Okay, so a year. Jimmy Fallon takes over The Tonight Show. I don't know if that's good or I don't know if that's bad. I'm kind of more of a Jimmy Kimmel fan myself. But in any way.
He does a great Bruce Springsteen, I should say.
Oh.
And he does a great Neil Young.
Who does a great Neil Young?
Jimmy Fallon.
He does?
He's fabulous. Yeah, he's great.
I've not seen that. Okay.
That's his best stuff.
Up next, I can't wait to talk about this. We're going to hit the road with Christopher Lydon. His take, new movie out about him, on Jack Kerouac. That's next on Open Mic. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Listening to Boston Public Radio, I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Marlon Brando said no to Jack Kerouac when he was asked by the author of On the Road to play Dean Moriarty and co-star with him in the movie version of his epic. That was in the late 50s. Well, someone finally says yes as the movie is now in theaters around you. We're going to talk about the movie, and with its release, we're going to talk about whether or not On the Road and its lull-born author, Jack Kerouac, are still relevant 60 years later. And with us to have that discussion is the man behind opensourceradio.org. That, of course, would be Christopher Lydon. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Marjorie. Good
day. It's afternoon. I do the exact same thing. I know.
Whatever it is.
It's
something.
We're happy to have you anyway.
Were we going to get in a footnote on Anthony Lewis? I missed my best line last week.
Actually, before we start, you mentioned that there was an Anthony Lewis WGBH connection,
and
then we ended too soon. What is it?
Well, he started with the granddaddy of Public Radio News, Louis Lyons, who built this station 60 years ago. He was incredibly, he was often on McNeil Lehrer from here, and he was very, very generous with the 10 o'clock news. Payback in a certain
way.
Which,
by the way, was hosted by Christopher Lydon, if you don't recall, yes.
As was The Connection. One day, we were interviewing Walter Cronkite in his memoir phase on tour, and I said, "Who does the most trusted man in America trust?" And he said, "I trust Anthony Lewis."
And that's the way it is.
That's great. And may they say something even remotely as nice about any of us. Bless Tony. I'm still thinking about him. But sure, let's plunge into it.
Yeah. Can you give us a quick movie review, or do you want to just get into the whole?
Quickly. I thought it was good, not great.
Yep.
It's flawed, but it's going to drive a lot of people back to the book and to lots of other Kerouac that confirms he survived, and B, he's of the giant stature.
Want to leave the movie yet for a second.
I'm not leaving it.
Oh, you're not. Okay,
No. Let's talk about it. For me, the big thrill in the movie is America the Beautiful, the plains before the interstate. They look gorgeous. The great green land rolling by from a 1949 Hudson. Guys in wool plaid, lumbering shirts, smoking Camels. Migrant workers in those days picking grapes and cotton were mostly white guys out of prison or out of luck, drunk or sober. There was this wonderful institution of the Travel Bureau car, basically hitchhiking but sharing the gasoline expenses. And they came from everywhere, which we'll talk about. But there's also the big philosophical scope of that picture. And Allen Ginsberg's question, Whither goest thou, America, in thy shiny car at night? I mean, so a big dose of America.
Why does this never get made? I mean, considering how huge the book is in the lives of so many Americans, the Marlon Brando story when he was...
I heard it differently. Marlon wanted to play it, but they somehow couldn't finance the movie.
Well, I had heard, well, whatever it was, I heard Kerouac reached out to him. Brando said no. But years later in the 90s, I also learned this in the last few days, Francis Ford Coppola was contemplating doing it with Brad Pitt. That never happened. How could we have gone 55 years from this unbelievably iconic work, and it just hits the screen in 2012? How's that possible?
I don't know. Business is business, I suppose. I don't think they yet found the right guy to play Kerouac. They found this guy, Garrett Hedlund, whom I hadn't seen to play this unbelievably electric, sort of pansexual Dean Moriarty.
Oh, he was great.
Marvelous. He's extraordinary.
He was great.
Another little detail, though. I mean, it's an America that we don't see anymore. Jack Kerouac loved listing locations. Eau Claire, Wisconsin, was his type of a city that he loved. It's on a river, and it is dark, and the stars shine stark bright, and there's something steep about the night, he wrote. This was 1949. Such towns, he wrote, as Oregon City, Holyoke, Massachusetts, Asheville, North Carolina, Gardner, Maine, Steubenville, Ohio, Lexington, Missouri, and, of course, Lowell, Massachusetts. I mean, we're remembering the biggest man on the Merrimack River between Henry David Thoreau and Mickey Ward in The Fighter, you know.
He's a little boy.
Yeah, another one. But
you know who else was born in Lowell, by the way?
Lots of
Betty
people.
Davis was born
in
Lowell
in
terms of great...
Yeah, I think
American
Ed McMahon,
artist.
Speaking of the Tonight Show, did time on a Lowell radio station.
I think that's true, actually.
Wonderful place.
But why are the Beats, and he was, of course, one of the Beat writers with Ginsberg, as you mentioned before, and all that, why are they still relevant? I mean, there was sort of he was talking about doing a lot of drugs, a lot of benzodrine, a lot of other things, a lot of sex. You know, this was during the very conservative 50s, and everybody was supposed to be conforming, McCarthy hearings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think the book came out in 57. Why is Jack Kerouac and On the Road still matter in 2013 when we're almost so blasé about drugs and sex and rock
and
roll?
Well, that's interesting. Several questions there. I like Tom McGuane's line, another marvelous writer in my book who came from here. His parents came from Ayer, Massachusetts. He went to Harvard, then drifted to Michigan and eventually Montana. But he said, Kerouac trained us in the epic idea that you didn't necessarily have to take it in Dipstick, Ohio forever. Kerouac sent me out there with my own key to the highway.
That's a great line.
It's a wonderful
That's
line.
That's a great line.
And everybody's still looking for a key to the highway. The sex thing is interesting. On the Road is, of course, a breakthrough book. It sort of paves the way for gay literature and also for an explosion of black literature and the civil rights movement in a certain way. I thought that was somehow frozen in the movie. We're seeing, I mean, this very charged homoerotic relationship between Kerouac and Neil Cassady was the guy's real name. And it's there. It's important. It's important that they're writing about it, but they don't put a name on it, and neither does the movie. They could have been celebrating this as kind of the dawn of the age we live in.
Right.
And they don't. I think there's another interesting question in my mind, whether they made the movie for, Kerouac cultists, of which there are many up on the Merrimack today, I hope they'll call, as opposed to making it for the youth market. The flip of that is that Kerouac's breakthrough made a lot of the world that millennials live in today, especially their uncaring about race and sexual differences, their openness to spiritual issues, which is new after the Lost Generation and maybe new again today. Kerouac himself was drawn like a magnet to every kind of diversity and all the ambiguities of sexual life, way ahead of his time. And at other levels, I want to talk about it. He was a very hopeful searcher. He was a real believer. He was a sufferer. But he was an ecstatic enthusiast about the search for meaning in this world, quite unlike Hemingway and Fitzgerald.
Let me give the phone number for a second, because you say we're looking for a Kerouac cultist, and you don't have to be a Kerouac cultist. You can give us a buzz anyway at 877-301-8970. While we're not going to ask your specific age, I'm interested when people call about what generation they're from. Despite your answer to Marjorie Chris Lydon, we all read this as teenagers, I assume, it's safe to say. You're a teenager in 2013. You know nothing about the book except your professor said it's an American classic. You read it with no prior knowledge. What's your reaction to the book in 2013 as an 18-year-old?
Let's get out of here.
Yeah, I think that's true.
It reminds me of Good Will Hunting. I mean, what do they want to do? Get out of here. And the last scene is on the road. This is Bob Dylan. Do kids read Huckleberry Finn anymore? I mean, it's sort of heading for the territory, but this is the one they read, they hide under the bed. This is the real thing. They faced danger, they faced adventure, they faced, again, this sexual mystery of what that's all about. This was a kind of guy world, sort of in the Athenian mode. Girls were great, and we need them, by God, and they're beautiful, but this adventure of figuring out, confronting the mystery of our lives is something guys have got to do together. I don't know. I think kids do that still.
And yeah, I have the sense, and the Kerouac himself was a very sad guy. I mean, he was a serious alcoholic. That's what killed him at a very young age. I think he was only in his
40s,
late 40s,
right?
Yeah, when he 40s. Died. Yeah, so, you know, he did a lot of searching, but it didn't seem to get him very
far.
Well,
that's been the knock on the book. It's a great long search and full of hope, but for what? We never see it. The other piece is important, Marjorie. It's a funny thing. This is a movie about sex, drugs, and bebop. And Kerouac is into all of it very intelligently. But in some other way, he's the innocent bystander. Dean Moriarty is the driving daredevil. He's the car thief. He's the guy who, you know, can swerve that Hudson across a bridge with traffic going every which way, absolutely never blinks. And the Kerouac character is literally scared. I mean, he's sort of an innocent. He's almost shy with girls. He's scratching notes in his notebook all the time. That's his real job. And he writes about, as you say, the bleakness of my own days. He's breaking down in this novel. I also feel toward the end of the novel that he's sinking into a kind of chemical dependency on alcohol. I mean, he's losing it.
Let's take a couple calls if we can. 877-301-8970. The voice is that of Christopher Lydon. Let's take a call or two, and then we'll continue. Sean, you're actually in Lowell. You're on with Chris Lydon, Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan. Take it away, Sean.
Holy ground, Sean.
Hey, Sean.
How you guys doing?
Great.
That's good. I'm just calling. I'm 23. You know, I'm a huge Kerouac fan. I've seen the movie. I've read all of his books. And I can see exactly what you guys are talking about. The book still holds relevance today. It connects with me a great deal. You know, it has this romantic notion that I don't think that I couldn't do what he did. You know what I mean? There's no possible way that I could just hitchhike cross country. One, because people don't pick up hitchhikers, and do all these, and I mean gas and everything else, you know, but I would love to do that. And just to see that there was a time in America that this was possible and that he broke ground for all of us today is just something that's inspiring to me.
Don't be entirely sure you can't do it. I know a wonderful young guy in radio who walked from Seattle to Cape Cod over several months, and he had nothing but a kind of child stroller, no child in it, and he had a sign on it that said, "Here to listen." And I said to him, I mean, it's so Kerouacian, but I said to him, "Andrew, how is the country these days?" He said, "Chris, it's great." And everybody came up here to listen. And they said, you know, people would say, in a friendly way, coming to a gas station or a restaurant, "You're listening to..."
"To what?"
"To the sky, to God, to what?" No, he said, "No, listening to you. I want to hear your story." And people couldn't tell him enough. Anyway, I interrupted you.
Sean, is part of the allure of Kerouac because you're both Lowell kids, or is there something that goes beyond that?
No, it has nothing to do with that, to be honest. It's his style of writing. You don't have beat writers nowadays. Authors nowadays, I feel like most of the time they try to write cinematically. They try to write as if it's a movie, you know.
Good point.
And he doesn't do that at all. You know, it's
there's a lot of my friends and peers that just don't understand necessarily this type of writing, but I do think that it still connects with a portion of us.
Sean.
And I think that it's really inspiring.
Great call, Sean. Thank you so much.
Thrilled to hear, Sean. Keep doing it. Can I just throw out three slightly, you know, different lines about what I think Kerouac was really up to? Three points.
Mm.
One, he was a poet first and last. Second, he was passionately and not unconventionally religious. He was a French-Canadian Roman Catholic, much more than he was a Dharma Buddhist. And third, he was a musician at heart, or maybe a musician once removed. But first, about the poetry. This is the year not just of the movie, but of the Library of America's collection of Kerouac collected poetry. I mean, who knew there were 600-700 pages that brilliantly edited and introduced by a woman around here, Marilyn Phipps Kettlewell. So the book, that's that black book on the shelf that establishes he's in the canon now. But listen to this fragment called I Am My Mother's Son. And listen to the order of identities here. Say, fellow, you know who I am? I'm Jack Kerouac, the writer. Husky, handsome, intellectual Jack Kerouac. I'm the boy from Brazil. I love jazz. I love North Carolina. I love socialism. I'm selfish. I'm irresponsible. I'm weak. I'm afraid. I'm Jack Kerouac. Listen to this. I'm Jack Kerouac, the poet, the seaman, the scholar, the laborer, the newspaper man, the lover, the athlete, the flyer, the Lowellian, question mark? I am my mother's son. This guy wrote haikus, he wrote blues lyrics, in form and out of form. He wrote elegies, he wrote psalms. Check the psalms. He wrote confessions, he wrote prayers. He wrote, I'd better be a poet or lay down dead. And Marilyn Phipps Kettlewell adds this with a great artistic wisdom, I think. She writes, to be a poet's poet is to hurt singularly, to hurt incomprehensibly, to suffer a wound that never heals, a wound not meant to heal, because bleeding is the very nature of this wound. It is a divine gift. It is the wound of a savior.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Let's take a call or two. Christopher Lydon is with us, as he is every Thursday at 1 o'clock. Let's go to Dana. You're in Sandwich, and you're on with Chris, Jim, and Marjorie. Hey, Dana.
Hi. Thank you very much. Chris, great to hear you again, especially on the Beat Poets.
Thank you, Dana.
You're welcome. I was, I'm 62 years old. I really didn't appreciate them until my 30s when I read the Dharma Bums. And I had just thrown off the shackles of religious fundamentalism that I had willingly embraced. It was never forced on me. And the Dharma Bums, I really feel, was laying the groundwork for the whole so-called counterculture of the 60s, which I loved, and the civil rights and the women's movement and the animal rights movement. I mean, it was the foundation for all that, in my opinion. And so I feel indebted to Kerouac and Chris because of something you said in one of your shows. I listen when children want to play music for me or introduce, like my nephew wanted to introduce me to certain of the rock groups he was listening to, because I think Kerouac kind of inspired me to listen to younger people. They have something to say. I don't know at all.
Dana, thanks for a great call.
That's a great call. He was criticized for the Dharma Bums, though, wasn't he? Wasn't Kerouac sort of trash for that?
I don't know. I think there were myths about Kerouac, including that he wrote on the road on one long sheet of paper. That's pure nonsense. I mean, he wrote it over years. He wrote it in sections. He wrote it carefully. He may have typed it finally on one thing. But on the Buddhist thing, I think that's exaggerated. You know, Gregory Corso, wasn't it Gregory Corso? No. Who was it? No, Gary Snyder went to Japan, became a full-fledged serious Buddhist. That was never for Jack Kerouac. I mean, I think he was a Catholic, as a lot of us are, you know, to the grave.
Can I tell you how deflated I am? The fact that you said a second ago that he did not write this on one continuous piece of paper. You know, these legendary things.
It's even in the movie.
It is in the movie?
Yeah, and there may have been one long manuscript
I will
at some
choose
point.
To continue to believe it then, if it's okay
but,
with
no,
you.
No, the idea of this unconscious dream, he was a reviser. All these things were myths that he probably, you know, conceived himself. I want to make just a note about the religion, keep it very, very
yes,
brief.
Yes.
But, you know, Beat, as in Beat Generation, Beat Poet. But Beat is short for Beatus, as in blessed, the beatific, imparting holy bliss. And this guy is a Catholic from Lowell. The spiral notebooks that Doug Brinkley has edited are full of crosses and Christ. He's asking spiritual guidance from God all the time. He's begging for grace and for forgiveness, and he's praying for divine intervention. He writes his own psalms, as I said. He talks to God. He talks about Jesus. I mean, this is a religious man's search. But now I want to just make this other big point. This is for you, Dana, too, about music. He writes in one poem, "I want to be considered a jazz poet blowing a long blues chorus in an afternoon jam session on Sunday. I take 242 choruses. My ideas vary and sometimes roll from chorus to chorus or from halfway through a chorus to halfway into the next." I got to say, my closest link to Kerouac has been his friend David Amram, a sort of ageless guy, composer, pianist, who accompanied Kerouac reading at the piano, and he wrote songs with him, including the famous Pull My Daisy, which I hope we'll hear. But Amram is also the personal bridge to the likes of Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker at the pinnacle, but that whole spirit of post-war jazz, when Kerouac calls it the moment between Charlie Parker's Ornithology, it's 1946, between Ornithology and the rise of Miles Davis. I mean, his calendar was music. At that time, when bebop was speeding everything up, it was changing rhythms and the phrasing, the clothing, the configuration of players, the whole thing. David Amram said that those great experimental musicians of the 40s and 50s loved to see Jack around because it meant that at least somebody would be listening. Jack also, according to Amram, was a fair to middling, but no slouch as a piano improviser, too.
We're going to play that music, by the way, in a couple of minutes. Let's take another call or two.
I just want to read one email that we have from if I weren't a wife and mother swallowed up by the Straits, I'd be a cultist on the Merrimack. I'm 38 years old and love this book as a teen. Read everything that he has written, and she's also from Lowell. Let's go to Stuart from Hopkinton. Thanks for calling, Stuart.
How you doing?
Great.
When I was a junior at Yale, I read On the Road for the first time and promptly dropped out and hit the road. I got into this beat-up 1978 Saab, and I drove out west. I ended up in the Grand Canyon for a while trying to figure out my life and was camping down there for 3 days. And when I came out, I kept repeating this one question, and I finally figured it out for myself. By the time I got back to school, I changed my major and got my life together.
Wow.
That is a great story.
How'd your parents cope with that, Stuart? I bet they loved that when you dropped out of Yale and drove to the Grand Canyon.
Well, they were glad that I went back.
Good.
Probably more than anything.
Hey, Stuart,
thank you kindly for the call.
Can I give you 1 minute on on music as the metaphor of
everything?
Sure. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, this moment in On the Road in the book. They're in a little dive in Chicago when out off the street came an apparition, a 16-year-old kid with a goatee and a trombone case, thin as rickets, mad-faced, and he wanted to join the group. But the band wanted no part of him. So eventually they all go out to Anita O'Day's club and they hear the great George Shearing. And then, they want to quit. I mean, there's nothing to be said after that, one of them says. But one of the others says, no, let's blow anyway. So they're back in the club, and here's what Kerouac writes. Something would come of it. There's always more, a little further. It never ends. They sought to find new phrases after Shearing's explorations. They tried hard. They writhed and twisted and blew. Every now and then, a clear harmonic cry gave new suggestions of a tune that would someday be the only tune in the world and would raise men's souls to joy. They found it. They lost it. They wrestled for it. They found it again. They laughed. They moaned. And Dean Moriarty sweated at the table and told them to go, go, go. At 9 o'clock in the morning, everybody, musicians, girls in slacks, bartenders, and the one little skinny, unhappy trombonist, staggered out of the club into the great road of Chicago, the great road of Chicago day, to sleep until the wild bop night again. That's Kerouac.
He could almost be
the trombonist, but he's this driven experimentalist. He's a compassionate encourager of other young artists. That's you, Stuart. And he's still there.
Let's take one more quick one. David from Lexington. You're on with Chris Lydon and Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, David.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
Welcome, David.
Thanks for calling.
Love your show.
Thanks.
I first went across the country by car when I was four in 1957 in the 1950 Studebaker.
Wow.
I drove myself across when I was 17 in an 8-year-old 62 Falcon. And after I graduated from college, I rode from Seattle back to Boston on my bicycle.
Oh, on your bicycle.
Yeah, yeah. It was 6 weeks. And, you know, the country was lovely then.
Was this because of Kerouac, David? Was he your inspiration?
No. Oh. My inspiration was the trips that my family of origin took when I was a little kid across the country. We went between Seattle and Boston several times. You know, I can remember on one of the car trips that I took, coming up to the top of the mountains above Salt Lake City and seeing Salt Lake nestled in the valley. I could see the whole Salt Lake Valley out before me, and there were places where it was pouring. It was pouring where I was, but there were also places in the valley that was sunny. That's how big it was. And Salt Lake was just a tiny piece of that valley. 10 years ago, I drove over that pass again for the first time in 30 years, and suburbs had filled the Salt Lake Valley, you know.
Yeah.
And that's, our population is now 50% larger than it was when I bicycled across the country.
Hey, David, we've got to move.
Thank you
for your version of On the Road.
That was a great call.
Hey, Chris, can you set up this music piece,
Steve,
that you brought with you?
Well, this was a recording that David Amram did spontaneously on a piano with me. We were just talking about Jack and the friendliness, the warmth, the complete responsiveness, the compassion of the guy. And then he broke into this song, which Kerouac and he wrote together, and he sings it.
Pull my daisy, tip my cup, all my doors are open. Hop my heart for coconuts, all my eggs are broken. Hop my heart song, harp my light, sorrows hold me steady. Hip my angel, harp my light, lay it on the needy. Hop my heart song, harp my light, sorrows hold me steady. Hip my angel, harp my light, lay
nonsense, fun, pleasure, music, blues.
Put the period on the sentence, Chris Lydon.
I just want to say Harold Bloom would kill me for calling Jack Kerouac Walt Whitman on wheels. He is not Walt Whitman, Harold. Relax. But he's a greater man, a greater writer, a greater American, and he's going to be here for a long, long time. Longer, I think, than you realize, Harold.
Chris
We've
Lydon,
been talking
Jack
with Christopher Lydon. That was wonderful, Christopher Lydon. He joins us every Thursday at 1 o'clock. I love every second of talking with Christopher Lydon.
Thank you, Chris.
Tune in tomorrow at 1 o'clock for Open Mic with Emily Rooney. Coming up, how is the class divide playing out in our daily lives, from the baseball park to the airport? That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And Marjorie and I talked about this about a week or so. Well, obviously, it was exactly a week ago. People paid as much as $6,000 to get a space in the courtroom for the gay marriage debate at the same time that we all waited for the oral tapes to be released in the afternoon. Opening day is next Monday at Fenway, but not for mere mortals. Here to discuss what one Harvard professor she interviewed called the, I love this word, the skyboxification of America. With us, and we're so thrilled she is back, and she's the host of the Innovation Hub right here, Kara Miller. Hey, Kara.
Hey, how's it going?
Great to see you.
Thanks.
So
good to see you.
What is the skyboxification of America?
So this is Michael Sandel, who is a kind of famous professor from Harvard. Apparently, he's actually a superstar in China, but who knew?
Really?
Yeah, he's friends with Tom Friedman. I found this out from a Tom Friedman column who says this guy is like a rock star in China. Anyway, I digress. So the skyboxification is a essentially, when Sandel was a kid, he loved going to see the Minnesota Twins. He grew up in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And it was $1 to sit in the bleachers, and it was $3.50 to sit in the skybox. And basically, what he says is there's gotten to be such a huge, so $2.50 difference. And now there's such a huge difference between the people who sit in the bleachers and the people who sit in the box seats. But not only that, it used to be that if you got rained on, you just, period, got rained on, whether you were in the box seats or whether you were in the bleachers. That is not the case anymore. People do not all eat the same hot dogs. They do not all drink the same beer. They don't all go to the same restrooms and stand in that long line.
Uh-huh.
So there is a different reality for the people who have a lot of money. And he uses that as a launch pad to talk about all sorts of things, like standing in line for Supreme Courts. You can pay somebody
$50 an hour. We talked about it last week.
You got it. To stand in line for you. And lobbyists do that all the time. We heard about it with the Supreme Court, but they do it all the time for important hearings. They will get, like, even homeless people off the street to stand in line for them. And at the very end, they'll be like, okay, see you later, buddy. I'm going to go in and hear this hearing.
You know, some of this is subtle and some not so subtle. We mentioned Fenway opening day. Marjorie and I did a show a couple of years ago. We were so excited. They're finally just starting to serve, I think, hard liquor at Fenway. And we're saying, boy, it's going to be great. Make the fun game more fun. And midway through the conversation, someone called and said, unless you're sitting, what's it called, the 600 Club or whatever.
Yes.
Unless you're sitting in the 600 Club, which obviously is much more expensive to even get into, you don't get served those drinks. Mere mortals get the $8 beer, which is only $5 for a month, but that sort of thing.
Watered down beer.
So, but when you talk to Sandel, and by the way, he's one of the few people who ever stood toe-to-toe with Colbert and came out even, I should say,
yeah, right.
Which is a real tribute to him. Is this far worse than, I know you give the $3.50 and $1, but there's always been this divide. There's always been the haves and the have-nots. We called them the occupiers and the one percenters, you know, a year or so ago. But is it worse, the skyboxification today, than it's ever been?
Or? I think it is. Well, certainly that example of if you had the most money to see the Minnesota Twins, right, you were still getting rained on. You were still eating the same bad hot dogs as everybody else, and now you're not. But you can use now money to buy yourself out of the healthcare system. There's something called boutique or
right.
concierge
doctors,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Well, you can pay a few more $1,000 a year than above and beyond your regular HMO or PPO. You can get the cell phone number of your doctor. You know how, like, you or I, we call up, we say, we want our yearly physical. They say,
right.
Yeah, we'll fit you in 4 months.
Exactly.
Right? They could fit you in 2 days if you had concierge medicine.
Well, you have concierge medicine.
No, I
don't
do
you?
Not, Margaret. I just have a lot of doctors. I don't
retainer.
Have concierge anything.
You can't tell us about it.
I could, but
lines.
I won't. Let's put it that way. Our number is 877-301-8970. Because one of the things I want to hear from people, you describe it perfectly. Sandel describes it perfectly. I think we have become so hardened to this. Intellectually, we get it. And everybody can recite the injustices, whether it's the line outside the Supreme Court that you can't afford to be in or to pay that homeless person to stand in, whether it's the tickets you can't afford, whatever it is, or the skybox. But it seems to me it's become so much a part of American life that while we complain about it, people seem to accept it as this is the way things are. They get it. We don't get it. Is that an unfair statement?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you go to the airport and
perfect.
And people who have a bag to check, right? You're in first class. You stand in a line that has nobody in it,
right.
Versus a line with 1,000 people in it. Then you want to go through security. If you're in first class, you don't stand in line.
Yeah, sky priority, they call
right?
it, right?
Then you want to get on the plane. You get on first if you're in first class. Then you get on the plane. You have bigger seats
Excuse
and you have
me.
Food. It's
Excuse
like a
me.
Totally different reality.
You know what drives me crazy?
What?
When you get on the plane and then you have to, most of the time, walk past the first class
that
passengers.
That is obscene.
And I'm
I agree.
Sitting there thinking, like, we're all sort of the cattle that go
and
in the
they're drinking
back of the
champagne
plane.
Already,
yeah.
That's
right.
By the way.
And I'm looking at people, and sometimes they're like 25 years old. And I think, where do they get this money? How can they afford to fly first class? And there's kids there, and you just feel you're such a loser going to the back of the plane.
Well, in a way, I think that is part of the perk of sitting in first
exactly.
class is getting to see all the people who are not going to be able to eat on the flight and who have to cram themselves
That's
into these
good.
Tiny bathrooms. Several weeks ago, I interviewed Chrystia Freeland, who is one of the big editors at Reuters, and she wrote this book called Plutocrats. And she has
Terrific.
This great quote from Holly Peterson, who is the daughter of the billionaire Pete Peterson. And she said, you know, but to be fair, $20 million is only 10 after taxes.
Oh,
that's
so,
a great line.
I mean, you might want to think about that
And
next
you heard
time.
What all the athletes say. I've got a family to feed. 877-301-8970. 89, 70. Do you agree, by the way, that people, I mean, with the exception of the year of the occupier, when we're all focused on the 1% and the 99%, people have settled that this is an acceptable way to live?
I think, as you said before, I mean, there's always been, you know, there was the Gilded Age and you had the Vanderbilts down in Newport with these mansions, and you had the people that were cleaning the house and stuff like that. But I think what's happened in the last 30 years and is that salaries, you know, this classic line, the guy in the line used to make 300 times less than the guy that owned the factory, and now it's something like 10,000 times less. Yeah. There's just been, you know, the haves are so far from the have-nots. That's what's changed dramatically.
And there are many more haves. That's what's also changed.
And the people that are really loaded, they're not even going to the airport. They're all flying in their private jets.
You're absolutely
so they
right.
don't even understand what the rest of us are talking about with getting groped by the TSA agents or going on the naked scanner. They don't understand it.
You know, Sandel cast this in my understanding, is in the context of sort of justice, equity, that sort of thing. And he hopes that there's going to be some big national debate that he says is going on in Asia, which is allegedly why he's so popular in China. With the exception of this fleeting moment with the occupiers, who a lot of people like to disparage, even though they were speaking for them in a lot of ways.
I love them.
We don't have this. There's no big debate, right?
Right, exactly. I don't think it's going on, but I do think there is a serious danger, as Sandel says, the way I see it is, okay, let's say you're the CEO of GE, right? And you're trying to decide on healthcare plans, or you're the CFO or whatever of GE, and you're trying to decide what healthcare plans are we going to offer the people who work at GE? Except you and your family have concierge medicine. You don't know what the difference between an HMO and a PPO. They're all just numbers on a
Forget
page.
Forget GE. How about Barack Obama and the 535 members of Congress who do not have to be part of Obamacare?
It's all academic. It's all academic. Nobody really knows what it feels like to have to call up Blue Cross Blue Shield and fight to get them to cover something. You know what I mean? I mean, seriously, my sister, who does not have Blue Cross Blue Shield, I don't think, has to go get her iron checked every year, and they charge her $600. For it because her insurance isn't covered, even though her doctor told her that she really needs to get that checked every.
That's terrible.
Everybody has these stories, except for a few people who unfortunately make a lot of
decisions. How do famous people get their driver's license renewed? I mean, I know you can do it online now, it makes it easier. But
there was a story 5 years ago when Mitt Romney was running for the presidency of the United States.
That's right.
How he had to come back
to
have his license renewed, and he did not have, I'm so glad you brought that up, he did not have to go through what the rest of us do at the RMV, but he got a special deal, and he was able to go to some, there's a special place for VIPs. 877-301-8970. Does this stuff bother you? And if it does, what's the one piece, like Marjorie's story of walking past the people in first class drinking champagne? What's the one? One for me, I have to say, the Supreme Court, I so much wanted to be in that courtroom to hear the Prop 8 or the Dome. I mean, it's history of $6,000, $50 an hour. What's it called? Standinginline.com or whatever name of the website
was.
That put me over the edge. Michael, you're in Framingham. You're on with Kara Miller and Jim and Marjorie. Welcome, Michael.
Yeah, good day. I find it amazing. Like, for instance, my sister pays, I think, $900 a month for health insurance and then squabbles to try to get appointments and get in. She's got two-week waiting things. I carry a catastrophic health, which is not accepted by Mass, and I pay the penalty every year, but it still brings me in at half her cost for my health insurance. And when I go see my doctor, I actually just pay him cash. And when I pay cash, I can call up and say, look, I need to see you this afternoon. He'll fit me in. I pay cash, and I'm in and I'm out.
Really?
What does that mean? So he doesn't have to pay taxes on it? What's that about? I never heard of that.
No. It's not like an under the table thing. I'll run it through my credit
supposedly,
card,
Michael. That's what they all say.
No. But I mean, I'd asked him at one point. I said, "Why is it when I use my health insurance, it's $250 for the visit, and then I pay my copay of $110? So if I come in and I just come in and out for a quick visit, it's $85 if I pay immediately." And he says, "Well, the overhead cost of waiting to get paid 90 days for the insurance, plus all the administrative process, isn't worth my time. So if you're willing to pay up front, pay the moment that you come in and you get your services, then I'll get you
but
in
Michael,
and get out."
But, Michael, that only solves one problem. That doesn't solve our problem at Fenway Park or our problem on the airlines. You know what I'm saying?
Michael, we can hear the aggravation in your old voice. Thank you.
Here's the reason I think that people don't like to talk about this, because when you mention any, you hear this over and over again, well, this is a capitalist country. You can just make as much money as you want. There shouldn't be any limits on that. There shouldn't be any thinking about this grand, you know, if Donald Trump makes $1 zillion, or, you know, the Microsoft guy makes $1 zillion, good for him. He made the money. People, seem to be oddly concerned about the unfairness.
You know, the interesting thing, too, is, you know, we talked a little bit, touched on Mitt Romney. Chrystia Freeland told me the story where she was saying that when she interviewed people who had made their money, the Mitt Romneys. I mean, Mitt Romney, yes, yeah. Of course, was born into
third
a fairly
base,
wealthy
but
family.
But, made a lot
but
of money.
Right, he made most of the money he has, he made by himself. And when she interviewed those people, she thought, you know, these people are really going to sympathize, like what you're saying, what it's like to be the regular Joe. And in fact, those people were some of the least sympathetic people because basically they thought, like, dude, what's wrong with you? I made $500 million. Why aren't you? And in fact, she had a conversation with some of the Russian oligarchs. And one of the Russian oligarchs.
Love them.
Yeah, exactly. Said, a man is not a real man. Like, there's something wrong with his manhood if he is not an oligarch. So, you know, think about that.
Who could disagree with that?
Exactly.
877-301-8970. You know what the other flip side of this thing is? What?
Are you a real man?
I'm an oligarch. Yes, I am.
Just wanted to check.
You know what? The flip side of this is we're talking about the gap for like the skyboxification, the gap. But when you get to go to the skybox, literally or figuratively, don't you feel that you're doing something that's unfair? Don't you feel like you got to
be... That's just because you came from the bleachers.
No, I'm saying, but that's exactly right. It's sort of like, while people like me, and I think Marjorie to a degree, and Kara, I assume you too, say there's a fundamental unfairness here, that they get to do that, we don't. They get to do this, we don't. But occasionally when you do get to do that thing, this you get to sit in the literal or figurative skybox, don't you sometimes feel guilty about it? You sort of feel, well, everybody else doesn't get to do this.
I'm happy to be there. I've not been there long enough to feel guilty.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do know what you're talking about. Do you know the name Foster Freeze?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Right, supported Rick Santorum, right?
He was the guy who did the thing about the aspirin between the knees is the best form of birth control. Right.
That's exactly right. So he has argued that rich people, many rich people would really disagree with you on this. He has argued that wealthy people, because they are wealthy and because of, you know, all the things they've accomplished in life, should not have to pay taxes. They should impose a self-tax, i.e. they should contribute to whatever religious group they want to or charity group or whatever, because wouldn't they be the people, those people at the top, wouldn't they be the people that would know the best how to allocate resources? So my answer to you is no.
Laura, you're in Cohasset. You're on with Kara Miller, Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan. We're talking about the skyboxification of America. Thanks for the call.
Hi.
Hi.
So here's my question, and I get what you're saying, but where does this argument end? Are we going to say that everybody should drive Toyotas? If you have the money to buy a Mercedes, is that unfair? Like, I see it as you're buying a service.
No, it's a good question. I mean, does it end with Lenin on the barricades?
No, the answer. I assume the answer to Laura's question, Kara, is that we have to create a society in which everybody has an opportunity, if they want, to be able to buy the Mercedes.
I think it should end with the 15% tax rate for zillionaires. That's where I'm ready to make it. Warren Buffett has said
that it's probably not right that he pays the lowest tax rate in his office. Right? He pays about 15% a year, and his secretary pays about 32%.
Right?
Yeah.
On his interest.
Exactly, right. Exactly. Because like 99% of his money doesn't come from his salary.
Right. And the argument is he's already made the money, so he shouldn't have to be taxed the same rate again. But I don't buy it for 1 second, Laura. I think
that's different. That's different than what we're talking about. It's sort of like, you know, I have a daughter who's very dyslexic, right?
Yeah.
She's also extremely bright.
Yeah.
But her dyslexia kept her from going to Ivy League schools.
Yeah.
So... you know, there's just, I do think that you're never going to be able to take away inequities.
Well, hopefully we can mute the disparity. But Laura, thanks for the call.
I guess there should be. To me, what we need is a little bit more embarrassment about some of this. I mean, there's no sense that anybody should feel, you know, that when they're living like Marie Antoinette, that there's anything wrong with that, even though Marie Antoinette has been disparaged in some cases. But you know what I'm saying.
And beheaded.
Yeah.
Other than the beheadings, though,
there was some debate about how much, whether she ever said the let them eat cake and all that kind of stuff. But you know what I'm saying.
Sure.
And we have a culture, I think, that just admires that, which is why when we have buffoons like Donald Trump, even though we say he's a buffoon, we're never going to talk about him again or mention him again, we keep going back. And people actually thought he'd be a great president.
Marjorie, he was leading in the polls. Yes.
Yeah, Donald Trump was leading in the polls. So I think it's a cultural thing.
Well, I also think, you know, in my lifetime, things have moved quite a bit. I remember going to Ben and Jerry's. You know, have you ever been on that tour?
Oh, yes, in Burlington,
yeah,
Vermont.
Years and years ago. And they said, we have a policy that the CEO, they're the highest paid employee, will never make more than seven times the, you know, janitor, the lowest paid employee. Well, now CEOs make about 350 times the lowest paid employee. So, I mean, and of course, Ben & Jerry's was always very progressive. But, I mean, the gap, we have kind of entered a new gilded age. And I think one of the things you see is that people, CEOs, their compensation committees tend to be made up of their friends.
Exactly.
And then they serve on the compensation committees of other CEOs. It's a little bit of a self-reinforcing cycle. I don't exactly know how you break it.
If you want a perfect example of that, rather than just the concept, is we spoke a week or two ago to Brian McGrory, the editor of the Globe, about his series on Ted Kelly, the $50 million a year head of Liberty Mutual. And that's the story, is that he sits on the board of John Doe. John Doe sits on his board. And ultimately, they do whatever they have to do. Speaking of what they do, what are you doing tonight at 9 o'clock?
So you can hear the Michael Sandel.
Oh, it's tonight?
Yes.
Oh, great.
You can hear the Michael Sandel conversation. I think he's a really interesting guy. So, yeah. So tune in.
He's a superstar. He's a superstar locally, too. He's a big deal over in Harvard.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's not exactly some schlub, except in China.
Yeah.
No, he's a big deal here, too.
9 o'clock Thursday nights, 10 o'clock on Saturdays, correct?
10 a.m.
And
this Saturday, we'll have a really interesting guy who's looking at rethinking crime. And then we're also going to have actually one of those gajillionaires, the guy who used to be the chief technology officer at Microsoft, made like $1 billion and then decided, you know what I really want to do? Reinvent cooking. So we're going to have him on Saturday.
I think you should demand to give you a huge tip for his time he's getting on your radio show.
Yes.
Karen Miller,
yeah, I will.
I could be dishonest and say, because I really don't want you to go, I'd like you to stay 5 more minutes. Or I could say, our next guest, Kevin Paul DuPont, will not be available for 5 minutes. So why don't you stay and we'll take a few more calls.
Sounds good.
We got a lot more
for
calls
For all
here.
Those reasons, we're thrilled that Kara's going to stay with us.
Kevin in Hyannis.
Hey,
what do
Kevin.
You think about this whole sky boxification of America, Kevin?
Hi guys.
Hi.
Hey, it drives me insane. And not the disparity between the haves and the have-nots. I mean, since Cain and Abel, there have been haves and have-nots. You know, that is never going to change. But this thought that everyone should be entitled to everything is just like Jim. You had just said we should set up a society where everybody who wants one should be able to get a Mercedes.
No, I didn't say – no, I did not. So let me correct you, and then you can continue.
Oh, yes, you did.
I said everybody should have an opportunity to do well enough that if they want to get a Mercedes, they can. I'm not saying everybody should have –
have that society right now.
Well, I don't think we do, Michael.
Kevin,
my apologies, Kevin.
That's okay. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's okay.
We do. Who is – being, you know,
I'll give you an example.
Kevin, crummy schools. Crummy schools. If you can't get an education, you can't succeed. If you can't get more than a sixth grade education, you're kind of got the shaft.
I disagree with that.
You do?
You guys just had a story on here this week about a guy who couldn't finish his high school, or rather his college education for at WPI, Worcester Polytechnic.
Yep.
He just retired, and he donated $7 million to the school.
Yeah, but, Kevin, that's different than not being able to read, and that's the problem. I think – I mean, nobody's going to say you can get an education in the inner-city schools in America anymore. Who's going to argue
Bill
that?
Hey, Bill Gates didn't graduate. We don't
Do we really have a problem to say that there is this monstrous group of people who can't read?
Yes, you know, too.
Let me say here that – I mean, look – Ibi Caputo, who's a reporter here at WGBH, just did a report on poverty in Suffolk County, and she looked at a family that, you know, I think struggles with health care, struggles with schools. You know, it's very hard to say that there is no difference between a five-year-old who has boutique concierge medicine, who if they have a problem can get in easily, and a five-year-old who doesn't have that, between a five-year-old who has the greatest preschool and a five-year-old who has really bad preschool or kindergarten. Yeah. You know, between a five-year-old whose parents are stressed out all the time because they just don't have anything, and a five-year-old who clearly has all the capabilities capabilities and all the luxuries in
first
life.
First class.
And nobody would say that five-year-olds, right, caused that problem.
By the way, not only listen, Kevin, last piece of advice. Kara's right. Listen to Ibby's report and read something called Savage Inequalities. It was written a long time ago that says it well. And, you know, last thing, Kevin, thanks for the call. Last thing before we take a brief break. The estate tax. I mean, I hate to give people a headache. I'm not fair or unfair. You can have a different view. The ability to pass along wealth in this country is colossal. So everybody doesn't start with the same deck of cards.
But,
in any case,
but Jim, what? $20 million is only 10 after
exactly.
taxes.
And you got to feed your family, don't you?
In any case.
Thank you, Kara. Kara's not going
it's
away.
Not easy.
We're going away for about 60 seconds. We'll be back with Kara Miller and you right here on Boston Public Radio. You're listening to, what are you listening to? Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. And Kara Miller, who is the host of the Innovation Hub, 9 o'clock on Thursday nights, 10 a.m. I don't know if you know, it's in the morning. 10 a.m.
on
Saturdays. In case you weren't clear, on Saturdays. And she's got this Sandel guy from Harvard who has come up with a term that I think so perfectly captures what we're talking about, the skyboxification of America. If you've got the dough, now more than ever, your ability to live a totally different life, whether it's getting in the Supreme Court hearing or listening to it on the radio, is never more extreme. Let's take a few more calls for Kara, if we can. Mike in Roxbury, you're on with Kara Miller right here on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey,
good.
Great.
I have no problem with, like, CEOs and people making a ton of money, you know what I'm saying, and even not getting taxed, too. I mean, the main thing is that everybody gets a fair opportunity to get to that point. And I think the best way to do that is, like, either, like, socializing or opening up the natural resource market and take away from the private market, basically. Because basically that's the source of everything that's made, you know what I'm saying? And then from there you could use your knowledge and make a TV or whatever you want to do.
But, Mike, you said at the beginning of the conversation you don't care how much money they make, you don't even care if they pay taxes. But so aren't those two ideas sort of antithetical, sort of everybody shares equally as opposed to the big boys and girls take home all the whatever?
No, not at all. I'm just talking about the source of everything that's made comes from the earth, you know, the natural resources.
Yeah, okay.
And if anybody has an opportunity to get to that or at least reap the benefits from the production, I mean, from the gathering of that, you know what I'm saying? Everybody would have a fair playing ground, you know what I'm saying?
We do.
I don't think that it's fair that someone could claim a mountain and say, oh, I'm the only one that could get gold from this. Now the only way you could work, I mean, to get gold or diamonds or whatever from that person is if you work for that person, you know what I'm saying?
Well, how about owning part of the ocean when wind farms? That's come up in the whole discussion of the Cape Wind kind of thing. Mike, thank you for the... thank you for the call. We'll listen tonight. Does Sandel have any hope that this is, I know he thinks this is great intellectual discussion in Asia. Does he think there's ever going to be a serious discussion in this country?
And I have to say, the wealth gap in Asia is enormous. I mean, that's part of the reason I think that they're interested, because it's just amazing how many billionaires there are in Asia now. And there's all these incredibly poor people working in factories, too. So I have to say, the wealth gap is not just here. It's everywhere. I don't know. I think he really wants to start a discussion about should there be things that we don't put a price on, whether healthcare, standing in line at the Supreme Court, should you be allowed to have surrogacy? You know, people pay a lot for the right eggs and sperm, honestly. Mm-hmm. I remember being in college. I don't know if...
They'll
advertise for like $30,000 if you have like the right color hair, the right color eyes, right SAT scores, right height, you know, you're at Harvard or Yale or Princeton or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question.
You finance your education selling eggs.
Are there some things that you should not be able to put a price on? And another person I interviewed several weeks ago, Jared Diamond, really interesting guy. He once talked about living in L.A., and driving by gated communities, and we could say this everywhere too, there are gated communities here. And he said, what happens when everybody in gated communities drinks bottled water, right? Not the water from the water system, sends their kids to private school, doesn't care about
public
school.
They have their own fire department. They have private public safety.
That's right. He actually talked about that. He said in Tennessee, there was a case a few years ago where the fire department came. This was the kind of fire department that you had to belong to. They came, they watched a guy's house burn down just to make sure it did not spread to a subscriber's house. So that's the question is, are there things we shouldn't put a price on? And that's the big question that he asks.
I'll give you one example of something we shouldn't have put a price on. I think we can all agree.
What's that, Jim?
Opening day tickets at Fenway. Do you think that's, ask Sandell about
that. How much does it cost to sit in like the nicest
skybox? It isn't
sky
even
box.
About how much money it is you can't even get
can't
in line.
Can't even get
that's
it, all.
No. Hey, Kara Miller, we're thrilled to see you. Kara Miller, tonight
nice to
at 9,
here.
Innovation Hub, Saturday at 10 a.m. We'll see you again soon, Kara.
Thanks.
Thanks to you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web at wgbh.org/BPR. You can tweet us at BOS, as in Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, this should be a knockdown, drag-out Friday news quiz. Peter Galzinis from your paper.
Yes, that's right.
And the great singer-songwriter Livingston Taylor. Two really tough quiz contestants. I'm telling you, it's going to be
brutal, Jim.
It's going to be wild
fisticuffs.
In here. We hope you're here. We'll be back tomorrow at noon. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Thank you so much for tuning in.
Have a great day.